Welcome to A Million Other Choices. Thank you for joining me. We discuss dark topics here, and sometimes things get hard to listen to. My focus is always on victims and their families and friends, which can be very hard to listen to, so please be advised of this. Ad-free episodes can be signed up for through Red Circle or Patreon, where you can also get access to full-length bonus content. You can make a one-time donation at Buy Me a Coffee. Disclaimer and sales pitch are done. Next up, legal. All sources are publicly available information, and I use a wide variety of sources to try to ensure accuracy, but I cannot confirm the accuracy of publicly reported information. If you would like a specific source or sources, please email me at amillionofthechoices@outlook.com and I will provide it to you. You can also email me there with case suggestions and just general comments. Okay, we are done. Let's get going with what you came here for today. I have a story for you today that as I go on, you'll probably realize that you've heard it before, but I think that some stories are just too darn fascinating for me to pass up just because other podcasters have sort of covered it. And most of the ones that I've seen that have covered it have done it more in the paranormal side. And of course, I have my own way of telling a story. And when I do, you kind of seem to like it. And a lot of you are just getting ready to drift off to sleep listening to my voice anyways. So just kind of settle in. I promise I'll make it interesting. And also, I didn't actually mean to get into this story because I myself have heard it before as well, but I obviously wasn't really listening because there's a lot to unpack here. We're going to be doing a deep dive, so buckle up and let's get going.
Obviously, have a very high tolerance for murder.
He is beyond saving. And I lost a piece of my heart that I'll never be able to get back.
May God bless your dark, broken soul.
Year-old Michael Sean Petrie had been born July 3rd, 1964 in Indianapolis to his dad Donald and his mom Annette. He was living in Noblesville, Indiana with his parents when he made plans to go with his friend Kurt to see a movie at the Eastwood Theater the evening of June 7th, 1980. And they were going to be going to go to the evening show. So the two of them went back to their respective homes to change clothes before the movie. And so Michael changed out of his black Bob Seger t-shirt sometime after 6 p.m. That's when his dad saw him and he was wearing the Bob Seger t-shirt. And he put on his red Indiana University jersey. But when Kurt showed up at the Petrie home at 7:30 to pick him up, Michael had already sort of left. Now, there's been a lot written over the years about Michael, a lot of which isn't really helpful to me and my nosy brain about what kind of person he really was. But he's been classified in the papers as a male prostitute. But I'm not sure about that at all. Like, he was known to have a job at Turner's Gym and was also known to hitchhike. And back in 1980, this friend of his, which I put in air quotes, who identified himself as Joseph Mill, who was 29 years old, quite a bit older than 15. He was also a grand jury bailiff at the time. He said publicly to the Indianapolis Star that he had last seen Michael on May 29th when he came to his apartment in Riley Towers. He said, quote, "He came to me to borrow $6 from me and I gave him heck, because he said he needed to pay back a friend and I didn't believe him." but his mother said he really did owe a friend some money. Now, when asked sort of when he had befriended him, he said, quote, "It could have been when he was working at Turner's Gym, but I remember picking him up hitchhiking." And then he relays this story that he had once driven with him to this dilapidated property in Brown County that was way off of the road. So he obviously had some dubious friends, but it doesn't necessarily make him a male prostitute. And when you're 15, like, can you even consent to paid sex? So I think he was more likely being trafficked. Well, on June 15th, 1980, Michael's nude body was found face down in a ditch by a farmer living in Noblesville. And he had been dead for about 2 to 5 days at that point and had been thrown into the ditch where he laid with such force that his body had left deep indents into the mud. There were no drugs found in his system. And then the cause of death was determined to be strangulation. There was some brouhaha over the positive identification of his body. Donald and Annette just really didn't want to believe or accept that the boy that they had found had been their son, but he was later confirmed to be Michael Petrie. On July 12th, a 50-year-old machine maker that was named Robert Heflin of living on 18th Street, he was arrested under suspicion of his murder. Now, he had a habit of picking up young boys around Michael's age and then paying them $10 for sex. When a search warrant was issued and done of his house, it turned up a bunch of Polaroids of young boys. But by September of 1980, he had been cleared of Michael's murder, any involvement in the murder, but he was charged and convicted of child molestation, or child mistreatment, as YouTube would prefer me to say it. And of course, tampering with a witness when he tried to intimidate a 15-year-old into not testifying against him. So although he was a complete twat, he was not a murderer. On July 21st, 1982, the half-naked body of Maurice Allen Taylor was found in Weasel Creek in Hamilton County. He was only 22 and living homeless, but he often sought shelter in this boiler room of this dilapidated apartment in Indianapolis. And then to make what money he could, he would turn tricks to men he had met in gay bars. His cause of death was actually impossible to determine conclusively, but was suspected to be strangulation. Now, Maurice's body would not actually be identified until later in the year of 1982, so it was originally brought in as a John Doe. Now, very little is actually known about Maurice and his childhood and what had brought him to Indianapolis to live in poverty and turn into prostitution for money. On October 2nd, 1982, 14-year-old Delvoid Baker left the house of his 62-year-old adopted mom, Pearl Townsend, and his stepdad, John. He was on his bike. This was around 4:30 p.m. He called his mom later that evening and told her that he was at the movie theater and that there was this man that was going to drive him home around 10:30. Pearl reported him missing to the police the next morning around 8:30 when he still had not come home. A friend of Delvoid saw him around 11 p.m. get into a blue van near the University Square Park, and the driver of the van was described as white with a bushy mustache. The morning that he was reported missing, about 10:30 in the morning, a man who was out riding his bike along Lantern Road found his body in a ditch. Now, he had been dead less than 24 hours. He had bruising around his neck that could have been either the result of strangulation or damage from his body being thrown out of a vehicle. It appeared that Delvoid had been killed somewhere else and then dumped off of Lantern Road. He was wearing black shorts, underwear, and his socks were still on, as well as his running shoes. A month later, the police were able to trace this blue van down to a man named August Cato. Now, a 47-year-old man, originally from Florida, named Duncan Patterson, had admitted to picking up Delvoid that evening near the Marin County Library and then paying him for sex. And then he dropped him off. Now, this guy, Duncan, was later cleared of his murder but charged with child molestation. August drove a 1979 Chevy Tahoe, which matched the description of the van that he was seen getting into at that time. And the area where he was picked up was known as an area where male prostitution activity was pretty heavy. Cato had this history with the police of picking up young boys. His son Vincent also had a criminal history when at 23 he repeatedly stabbed his mom Mary in the back. But on November 10th, when the lab results from the search warrant came back, they weren't able to link August to Delvoid's murder. On December 14th, though, he was charged with contempt of court for refusing to answer any questions about Delvoid. But for that, he was only given 60 days and a $500 fine. On May 28th, 1983, 22-year-old Michael Riley, whom friends called Mick, he went out to the Vogue nightclub on College Avenue. And according to Mick's mom, Norma, Mick was not a homosexual, but he liked to go to gay bars. And in 1983, I would think it would be an important thing for Norma to feel like she needed to say that publicly. But it really doesn't matter to any of us, or at least it shouldn't in 2025, if he was or was not gay. Now, regardless, I think gay bars are great places to go. They usually have the best music, so whatever, it really doesn't matter. Anyways, he was last seen leaving the Vogue with this man that the police later were able to issue this sketch of, but it's pretty generic. Like, he's got short hair, clean shaven, on a, like a side part, but the sketch information was given by one of Mick's friends, like classmates from school who knew him quite well. And he also, this guy, the witness, passed a polygraph test regarding what he had seen. So it was believable. But according to Sheriff Sergeant Gerald Schneiner, everybody and his brother knows someone who looks like our first composite that was displayed to the public, end quote. They also got a large number of prank calls, like suggesting all kinds of ridiculous people as suspects, which really slowed down the investigation. But his disappearance was being treated as a homicide from like the very beginning, as this was actually the seventh disappearance since 1980 of a gay man in this area. His body was found also thrown from a bridge on June 5th in a drainage ditch, which was just southeast of Greenfield. An object that was later determined to be a towel was tied around his neck. His neck also showed bruising as well as above his eyes. He also had a blood alcohol level that was over the legal limit at the time of his death, which they think his time of death was actually before his body was dumped from the bridge. He was shirtless like Delvoid had been, but his pants were still on him. But it wasn't until the 8th of June when Sergeant Jack Hanlon, who was leading the investigation into these recent homicides, theorized that there were likely actually two killers at large. One that they would probably be able to connect to the two Michaels and to Maurice. And then there was another one that they think killed 21-year-old John Roach and 22-year-old Daniel McNeve. Now, they had both been stabbed. And he said at that time, quote, "If you kill one way, you seldom kill another way," end quote. They weren't really sure in which camp to put Delvoid because although he was strangled like the two Michaels and Maurice, he was African-American where all the other victims had been white boys and men. So a couple of years go by with no further leads on any of the cases when on May 7th, 1985, 17-year-old Eric Rodage disappeared. His sister Heidi had reported him missing as a runaway that day from their College Avenue house. And on May 9th, just 2 days later, his shirtless body was found dumped and strangled with a rope off of Roscoe Road, which is a rural area near Lewisburg. However, because there had been some partially digested peanuts in his stomach, and Heidi had confirmed that he had eaten a peanut butter sandwich before he left the house, that he had actually been killed somewhere else and then dumped there, likely killed somewhere in Indianapolis and then driven out to the area where he was found. His brother was the one that had the unfortunate job of identifying his remains. Eric had been believed to have been going to some job interviews for like a summer job, but he didn't make it to any of the ones that he had told Heidi he had actually scheduled. And it was later learned that Eric associated with some people in the drug trade and may have been involved in dealing and using drugs and possibly male prostitution to sort of earn some money. But again, he's 17, so he's not a consenting adult. And again, it really doesn't matter what his lifestyle was. He didn't deserve to be murdered, certainly. Now, by this point, they had started to realize that there was, in fact, a serial killer at work, and they were working the cases. But being the 1980s and in the Bible Belt in Indiana, a decidedly very red state, it was difficult to get even the families to talk about the victims' lifestyles, and then even harder to get witnesses that in the gay community to talk, particularly that were working in the male prostitution community, to speak up about anything that they may have seen or heard. On August 15th, 1986, the body of a man in his late 20s was found wearing only his underwear in a ditch near Eaton, Ohio. And the man had strangulation marks on his neck that were consistent with a rope. He was registered at the time as a John Doe and then buried at a donated grave in Preble Memorial Gardens. And it wasn't until the fall of 1989 that fingerprints were able to identify him as 29-year-old Michael Allen Glenn, who had been born December 3rd, 1956, to his mom, Joyce. She later had his body moved to Bicknell, Indiana. Little else is really known about Michael Glenn. And then just over a year later, on October 15th, 1987, James Boyd Robbins Jr., who was a 21-year-old living with his mom, Nancy, born and raised in Indianapolis, left his mom's house around 10 p.m. And his naked body was found 2 days later in a ditch in Shelby County. Strangulation was, again, thought to be his cause of death as well, based on the marks that he had around his neck. There were conflicting witness statements that hampered his investigation. One of them said that they saw a red Jeep Wrangler near the scene where his body was found, but another said that there was a Chevy Blazer. And the only information that I could really track down on James was that he was born April 30th, 1966, that he left behind his mom, Nancy, his dad, James Sr., three brothers, Donald, Perry, and Joey, and then a sister named Tina, as well as he had step-siblings, Diana, Valerie, Jennifer, Bonnie, Connie, and Lisa. So then things were quiet for a short time until on August 12, 1989, when 26-year-old Stephen Lynn Elliott was found in his underwear, strangled with a rope and dumped near Interstate 70 near Preble County, Ohio. Now, Stephen had actually come out to his family as gay in 1979, but he had been turned out by his parents, Betty and Joseph, who have since passed away. He left the house and then developed a bit of a substance use disorder and then turned to prostitution. So thanks, Mom and Dad, for that. I only know that Stephen was born February 8, 1963 in Indianapolis and is buried in the Plainview Cemetery in Clinton County. And that's all I really know about him. Now, at 31, Clay Boatman, he was a licensed nurse. He moved to Woodmore Trace in Indianapolis to work at the Greenbrier Nursing Home. His mom, Donna, had died the year before, and he wanted to make a fresh start. He had attended Ivy Tech's LPN program and had a really close relationship with his father, Robert, and his sister, Jean, and his brothers, Bill and Mike, that lived in Richmond. That's where he had originally been from. He left his shift at the nursing home on August 7th, 1990, and had made plans to go to a place called Our Place, which is a local gay bar. He didn't show up for his next shift, and his family was, of course, calling around for him and like just kind of keeping an eye on the news. His car had been found without him a few days later in a parking lot in downtown Indianapolis. On August 14th, they learned that a body that sounded a lot like Clay's had been found by some teens playing along the north bank of Sugar Run Creek, which is close to Eaton. He appeared to have been tossed from the bridge on Paint Creek Road. They called the police station, and then his body was later identified, and his cause of death was also strangulation. But I just wanted to take a minute and read this. That is from the Paladin, item August 29th, 1990, and it's on page 10. Regarding your August 18th story concerning the murder of Clay Boatman, I felt I must respond as a close friend who is upset by your insensitive handling. I realize the headline, Police Identified Dumped Body, is the typical sensationalized wording that sells papers. On that point, perhaps I'm oversensitive, but imagine if the dumped body was your friend or family. However, the lack of respect given Boatman in the narrative that followed was inexcusable. What was the newsworthy rationale for saying that his fingerprints were identified through a drunk driving arrest? I think saying that he was identified through fingerprints would suffice. You certainly saw no need to personalize the article with something positive about him, yet provided unnecessary detail regarding a mistake he had made. The only good thing said was tainted by making it look like it was possibly untrue when you used the wording, Boatman reportedly graduated from RHS and received his LPN degree. Odd how he did not reportedly get charged with drunk driving. Had he not received his LPN license, he would not have been providing care, love, and medical help to the much overlooked and ignored population he chose to work with in Indianapolis. I hope you will find room to print this so that friends and family will have something printed in the Paladin item that may reflect the sensitive, caring person who brought as much joy. Finally, I hope that you will consider the necessity of smearing the victim in future tragedies such as this one. Now, this was written by a person named Terry A. Marsh, who lived in Danville. 18-year-old Thomas Clevenger, he never gave away any impression that to anyone that he may have been gay or worked in male prostitution at all. According to his friend John Kennedy, he was cocky. He was kind of a smart aleck. He said a lot about not liking expletive for homosexuals. Thomas was a bit of a troubled youth. He had lived with his father, Thomas Sr., in Ingalls, listed his address on Terrence Avenue using his friend John's address. That was what he used at the time that he was arrested for theft. He listed himself at that point as unemployed. Those charges were later dropped, but John said that he was actually, in fact, living with his mom, Darina. She last saw him when he left her place on September 5th, 1990. On September 12th, a man that was driving in Dark County, Ohio, saw his nude body on the side of an old abandoned railway track. He was already at that point in a pretty good state of decomposition. His cause of death has never been determined because of that. His family, including his brothers Murphy and Jason, refused to discuss any ties that he may have had to the gay community, if at all. However, the Indianapolis News discovered through some associates of his that shortly before his death, he had started to work in the sex trade to earn some money. And of course, this doesn't matter, and neither does the theft charges that were later dropped on him as far as anything to do with him being a victim of a homicide worthy of compassion, especially towards his family. But I just think, like, this is my personal opinion on this and nothing more. It is really difficult to admit that Taylor probably did use drugs. And why that is probably because it matters to some people. And those people are going to be the ones that are going to comment on podcasts and YouTube videos that it matters to them. You know, thinking that, you know, she was a drug user, she probably deserved it. Or like they think, you know, a sex worker, she did this to herself or whatever it is that they're thinking. And those opinions are going to be there no matter what the circumstances of somebody being murdered, including like people who have opinions like, why would you let your 16-year-old out of the house, or, you know, those kinds of opinions that like the opinion that nobody deserves to be murdered, that might not be shared by everyone out there, but you know that those things don't matter. And I know that those things don't matter. However, I also understand that in 1991, with the AIDS panic that was out there and Being in a rather conservative community, families aren't exactly thrilled to listen to those opinions, and they probably also understand that the police aren't maybe going to put as much effort into looking for someone who's considered a drifter or a sex worker or a homosexual as they maybe do on some other cases. But even if you look at it from a cynical perspective, police departments, they don't just have quotas for giving out tickets to make money for the community that they work in, which is something that they don't like to admit to. They also have these solve rates that they need to keep in the high percentages, and there's like a huge amount of political pressure for them to do that. So I think police departments are, for the most part, pretty motivated to solve crimes, even if they personally maybe don't find them that important. Like, I think there aren't too many police departments that actually want a series of unsolved cases of sex trade workers in their community or in their jurisdiction. It just looks bad. And I think there's other issues that the media maybe doesn't pick up stories until there's a series of similar murders when it comes to more marginalized communities. And there are, of course, whole communities that don't speak to the police due to the lack of trust. I know that I'm completely going off track here again, but this is just, again, it's my personal opinion. I think that we need to consider maybe decriminalizing the actual sex working and put more emphasis on monitoring the people that purchase the services from the sex trade workers. Like, I think they're the ones that are dangerous, not the sex workers themselves. I think it's the pimps and the traffickers and the customers that are really the issue. Anyways, on August 6, 1991, the body of 42-year-old Otto Becker was found dumped, fully clothed in a ditch in Henry County by a farmer. There was a cord still tied around his neck. Now, his death was initially not connected to the other homicides, mostly because of the fact that he was found fully clothed. Otto had been a homeless man. He lived out of his car. His parents were deceased, and he had actually a bad drinking problem. He had a number of alcohol-related convictions that spanned about the last 20 years before that. But he had died from strangulation. It was the same as the others. One of his convictions had actually been from an undercover officer that offered him $20 for oral sex. But it was suspected that his involvement in male prostitution had more to do with needing money than his sexual orientation, which I think is just something that I would probably apply to a lot of people, including some of the other victims as well. Like, I don't think sexual orientation has anything to do with the sex trade work. It's the, you know, it's the selling of your body for the pleasure of another person. It's not a preference thing. Like, I think most women who are working currently in the sex trade will tell you that they don't actually have a preference for fat, balding men in dirty t-shirts with enough chest hair to look like a Velcro vest and breath like an abandoned pig farm. But that seems to be the customer base. Anyways, all of these cases I've talked about so far went cold. And whoever this person was that was targeting these men was dubbed the I-70 Strangler, because of the proximity to the Interstate 70 where all of the bodies were found, abandoned in ditches, like they didn't matter. Then there was a series of gay young men that continued to go missing, but their bodies weren't turning up anymore. But the circumstances around their disappearances just looked suspiciously like the I-70 murders. But they couldn't locate the men or find any evidence that they had in fact been murdered. And they were all gay men or bisexual, but the men that were going missing had moved from like transient teens and young men that were maybe in the sex trade to men that were between 20 and 45 that frequented gay bars, but otherwise had jobs and fairly stable lives and no evidence of ever having been working in the sex trade at all. However, a number of them specifically had chosen Indianapolis to frequent these bars to meet men because it was a bigger center and they could be a little bit more anonymous about it. Like, again, being gay was still frequently something that someone would choose to live closeted with in the early 1990s. And many of them, because of their sexual orientation, had been abandoned by their families, which was making their disappearances harder to investigate if they had even been reported missing. Plus, it was believed, and like probably still is to this day to some degree, that a man that's gay who's maybe not being accepted or feeling accepted would want to go off and live an anonymous life somewhere. Now, I tried really hard to find as much information on these men as I could, but it really wasn't easy at all. And it's probably because for so many years they were missing persons cases and not necessarily homicide victims. There was Johnny Lee Bayer. He was 20. He went missing on May 28, 1993. Jeffrey Allen Jones, 31, went missing on July 6, 1993. Richard Douglas Hamilton Jr. was 20 years old. He went missing on July 31st, 1993. Now, he was reported missing by a friend of his. Alan Lee Livingston was 27. He also went missing on August of 1993. Stephen Sperlin Hale, 28, went missing on April 1st, 1994. Now, he was reported missing by his father, Donald. And then Alan Wayne Broussard, 28, went missing on June 6, 1994. And Roger Allen Goodlett was 33. He went missing on July 22nd, 1994. He was last seen getting into a light blue Chevy Cavalier with Ohio plates at Northern Pennsylvania. Matthew Frederick Kern went by Mike. He was 45. I think he was one of the oldest victims. Last seen on March 31st, 1995. Manuel Resendez was 34. He was last seen at a gay bar in downtown Indianapolis on August 6, 1993. When he didn't show up for work the next day at this children's home in Lafayette where he worked, the two friends that he had gone to the bar with, they said that when they were ready to leave that night, he had already left or they couldn't find him. And they, at that time, just assumed that he had left maybe with somebody. But when he didn't show up for work, that was when they reported him missing. And then 2 years later, Jerry Williams Calmer, 34, was last seen in Indianapolis on August 8th, 1995. Now, his vehicle was found in the parking lot of the Castleton Square Mall. Okay, so now I have to switch gears into the investigation into all these men's disappearances and murders. Assigned to the missing persons unit with the Indianapolis police was Mary Wilson. She was then in like her mid-40s. I think she's since passed away. She had started out as like an officer and had worked her way up to detective and then worked in sex crimes division before then transferring to missing persons. And she actually loved doing missing persons cases. She loved the sense of closure that she would get from finding someone's person and retracing someone's steps and that kind of thing. And she had been assigned as the lead on the Jeff Jones case. He was the one that went missing in July of 1993. She had also been given on her plate the disappearances of Richard Hamilton, Johnny Bayer, and Alan Livingston. She had early on started to see some connections between these disappearances, that they were all gay men and all last seen at a gay bar. And meanwhile, Virgil Vandegrift was working as a private investigator. He had originally been with major crimes with the police, but then when he retired, he started up this PI firm. And he did a lot of missing persons cases because families don't always trust the police to do the work for them. And one of the people that hired him around this time was Alan Broussard's mom. She wasn't going to be waiting around for nothing. And so she had contacted Virgil in early June, just sort of days after Alan had last been heard from. Now, Alan was known to be a fairly heavy drinker. He had last been seen at a bar called Brothers. So Virgil did what he normally does and put up some posters in the bars around that area asking for some information. But when he came across this little tiny article that was in the Indiana Word, which is like a gay lifestyle magazine, about this young man that had gone missing named Jeff Jones. And then only about a month after that, he started looking into Alan's disappearance. Well, then Roger Goodlett disappeared and Roger's mom showed up on Virgil's doorstep, not wanting to be told to wait the 24 hours or 72 hours or whatever the circumstances were. The circumstances of his disappearance were pretty much identical to Alan's. So Virgil and his partner Bill went and sort of toured the gay bars in town looking for anyone that might have seen someone the two men had maybe talked to shortly before they vanished. They did come up with a lead on this light blue car with Ohio plates, but really nothing further than that. So Virgil tried to keep the police department up to date on what he had learned, but they weren't all that interested in it. And they just kind of sloughed it off that, you know, these cases, they probably weren't even connected and whatever. And then into Virgil's office walks this guy that introduces himself to his secretary, Connie, as Tony Harris, which is not his real name. And he tells her that he had known Roger Goodlett and has some information that he had tried to take to the police, but they told him he was probably high at the time and that they didn't believe him. And they told them that if they saw this guy that he's talking about again, to get his license plate, you know, maybe come back then. And he had contacted Roger's mom and she had told him to speak to Virgil about it. And Tony had a rather disturbing and highly frightening story to tell. Not long after his friend Roger had disappeared in early August of 1994, Tony was out at the 501 Club and saw this guy that he had seen him around before, but never really talked to him. As a pretty unassuming guy, he was tall, thin, didn't really talk much. And on this particular night, Tony noticed him looking at one of the missing posters of Roger. And so he went over and he introduced himself and asked, like, did you know him and etc. And he said that he hadn't really, he'd seen him around, something like that. And this guy introduced himself as Brian Smart, which Tony kind of figured right away was a fake name, but he's not really alarmed by that. I mean, I guess gay guys give fake names sometimes. Well, straight guys give fake names sometimes. Anyways, they start talking and Brian says that he's in from Ohio. He's a landscape artist and was staying at this place while he was working on it before the new homeowners would be moving in. The place is just outside of town. It's swanky. It has a pool. And he asks Tony if he, you know, wants to go back with him and have a drink and maybe a swim. Well, they pile into Brian's gray Buick that had an Ohio license plate that Tony didn't really take notice of the numbers of, and they head north of Indianapolis into the suburbs. And Tony can tell as they're driving around, you know, they're starting to wind around some roads and turns, that they're getting into some like pretty wealthy areas. And he's seeing like horse farms and like really well-kept fences, landscaping, big sort of mansions that are set far back from the roads with these winding driveways. And they finally pull into this winding driveway of this two-door style mansion with a sign out front that said something farm like on it. Now, it's kind of told later that Tony knew from the minute that he saw Brian looking at this missing poster of Roger that he knew that this man had killed him and that everything that followed was just kind of this ruse to try and catch him. But based on the fact that, well, in, again, in my personal opinion, is that this all kind of started off as like an innocent encounter between two consenting adults. And based on some stuff that happens later, that Tony then realized later that this guy was super shady and freaking him out and probably downright scary. And it doesn't matter. I mean, Tony got out with his life, and if, you know, he feels better telling the story like he, you know, bravely ventured into this adventure, knowing all along that he was with a killer, and that he just wanted to get more information on him and intel, by putting himself into danger to get that information, then we're going to let him do that, because, you know, what he has survived and encountered makes him just a very, very lucky man. And I'm certainly not going to judge him for his choices, whether he walked into danger knowingly or stumbled upon it by accident. I've heard both versions of the story are kind of accurate. Anyways, the two of them entered from this side entrance, and Brian had a key. So far, everything is tracking with his story. He looks around a little bit briefly and sees that there's some furniture there, but also there's some boxes. So yeah, it looks like the homeowners are slowly starting to move in some stuff, but it's a little bit dark though, and Brian didn't turn on any of the lights, and then tells him to, you know, come on down because there's electricity in the basement, which is kind of weird. Like I've never heard of an electric company that turns on like the power in one part of a house but not in another. But fortunately, this isn't really like a basement, like a creepy basement, but it's more of this massive rec room with a wet bar and an indoor pool. So it's still pretty swanky. But there was something a little bit strange that I find horribly, horribly creepy about this setup. I mean, it was nice, it was fashionable even, but there was quite a bit of clutter around. And what that clutter kind of consisted of was a bunch of mannequins set up, dressed like almost like they were attending a pool party. So Tony looks around, he's a little bit disturbed, and Brian says, "I get lonely down here. They give me some company." Well, sure, thought Tony. So when Brian offered him a drink, he decided it was probably in his best interest to maybe not take the drink. Now, his refusal of this drink seemed to kind of cast a shadow over Brian's face of like disappointment, maybe a little bit of anger, but he excused himself briefly. And when he returned to the pool area, he was a lot looser, like more talkative and upbeat. So Tony kind of assumed he had maybe excused himself to do like a line or something. Upon his return, Brian said that, you know, they should get into the pool, which was a pool meant for doing laps in. It's not really like a lounging, leisurely kind of swimming pool. But they swim together in the nude for a little bit. And when Brian suddenly and very excitedly says to him, "Oh, I just learned this really neat trick." And he reaches on the pool's sort of ledge or edge for this thin hose that was kind of wound up and said, "If you choke someone while you're having sex, it feels really great. You get like a great rush from it. You just pinch these two veins," and he's indicating his carotid arteries, "and it's such a great buzz. You should see how someone looks when you're doing it to them. Like their lips change color. That's how you can tell it's working." So that's kind of a terrifying statement, especially coming from someone that you're currently alone with in a strange house. So when Tony tells Virgil this story, that his intent after hearing this was that the only way to find out how these particular sex games ended in his mind and his reasoning was sort of take it all the way with this guy. So this Brian guy asked Tony to do it to him. So Brian excitedly strips off all his clothes and lays down on this fold-out bed that he has. Just happens to have this fold-out bed by the pool, surrounded by these creepy mannequins, and does this thing that they're referring to as this game with him. Well, Brian, you know, he's pleasuring himself while he's doing it. And so when he's done, it's Tony's turn, only Tony, rather smartly, decided to fake unconsciousness early before he finally did actually pass out. He's just not liking the idea of what's going to happen to him if he actually does lose consciousness in front of this guy. So seeing this, Brian stops and lets him up, and then he's kind of shaking him awake and says that, you know, you scared me. You're like, you know, people can die doing this kind of thing. Like, yeah, we get that. Now, fortunately, by this time, Brian's sleepy from whatever these drugs or whatever he took. And so he's in his little afterglow and he falls asleep. Well, then Tony creeps downstairs to go through Brian's pants to try and find out what this guy's real name was. But this Brian starts making kind of awaking noises. So he abandons that idea and somehow managed to convince Brian to get up and drive him back home. Well, hopefully he didn't drive him home, but like back to town so that he could get the heck out of there. So Brian leaves him off, calls him a good sport, and they arrange to meet up again that following Wednesday night at the 501 Club. And so Tony then went to the police, and of course they didn't buy his story. It could be because he maybe told it in a way that, you know, he was this heroic character taking one for the team in order to catch this killer, rather than the way I think it actually went down was that he stumbled upon a really bad situation and he was just really lucky to have survived it. So he then took his story to Virgil, who did believe him, or at least felt that the story was worth checking out, and sent one of his men to station himself outside of the 501 on that Wednesday to see if this guy shows up. But he did not. But Virgil still sees potential in Tony's story. So he goes to the police and contacts Mary Wilson, who is, again, the one that's heading the missing persons cases. Now, I don't know whether she bought it or rejected his story outright, but the vague description of where this guy's house was, it was kind of like a wild goose chase that she figured she wasn't going to win. But she did station plainclothes police in several of the gay bars around town in the hopes that somebody, you know, would match the description that Tony had given and that they would saunter into one of these bars so they could at least question them. So she told Tony and Virgil, like, if you can get me a license plate number or like some kind of real identity, then I can do something with that. So over the next year, Tony had built like a friendship with Virgil's secretary, Connie. So he would, you know, pop in occasionally and talk to her. And, you know, leads are drying up for Virgil, who's being paid to find two family members for people. And he just couldn't really let the whole thing go. So he had this guy that sometime worked for him. His name was Bill Hisley, and he used to be a state trooper. So he knew the area and all the highways and byways like the back of his hand. And if anybody's going to be able to find this place, it's him. So he's sent to go look for this house, this yard that matches the description that Tony has given. But there's a number of like rich areas in the countryside around Indianapolis. And he does come across this house that kind of matches it's in Westfield. It has a sign out front that says Fox Hollow Farms. And Tony did say that there was a sign that said farm something or something farms. So he pokes around a little bit and they take some aerial shots of the property, which Tony says doesn't really seem like it has a long enough driveway for it to be the right house. And the property is owned by the Baumeister family. And the Baumeister family were owners and founders of the Save-A-Lot thrift store chain. Julie and Herb, they were Methodists, Republicans.
Herb Baumeister of Carmel saw it all.
I said to my son, they're going to hit that raccoon with a spray gun. And sure enough, they just strike right over its face and neck. You know, didn't even move it, you know, no effort to, you know, get it out of the way. So I happened to have a Polaroid with me, so I took a shot of the thing.
A raccoon, which met its demise on the yellow line, became one with the paint. The raccoon has since been removed. This is all that's left.
this was just, you know, if Hainer should have had a chalk line drawn around his career by state officials, there was no excuse for that. I mean, the poor thing deserved a better fate than that.
So just what is the explanation for this?
So about a year has gone by since Tony's chance meeting with this mysterious Brian Smart guy. And on the night of August 29th, 1995, so this is quite a bit later, Tony decides to have a night out at the Varsity Lounge. And while he's at the bar enjoying a festive beverage, well, who should walk in but this Brian Smart? So he tries to play it cool, chats him up a little bit, follows him outside to his vehicle, which was a pickup truck at that point, and casually takes note of the license number, which was 75237A. And the next morning, he hightails it to Mary Wilson, and she runs the plate, which comes back to one Herbert Baumeister, Mr. Shop and Save, or Save and Shop, or whatever it's called. Okay, now I have to change course again and tell you about the Baumeisters. Herb Richard Baumeister was born April 7th, 1947 to his parents, Herbert Sr. and Elizabeth. And a year later, a sister, Barbara, joined the family. And then in 1954, a brother, Brad, and then Richard in 1956. So Dad was a doctor. He was an anesthesiologist, and all the things were pretty normal for the family for the most part, but Herb was always two ice cream scoops short of a milkshake, you'd say. He was weird. Like, let's just put it that way. He had kind of friends in school, but they also found him weird as well. Like his friend Bill, who said that he sometimes pondered like what urine tasted like, and one time he picked up a dead bird and put it in his pocket on the way to school. You know, that kind of weird. People always seem to describe him as having like a weird sense of humor, like inappropriate, but not so much in a like a sexual way, but just in like the things that he found funny were not really funny. So his dad also noticed like his weirdness and apparently did take him to a doctor who diagnosed him as schizophrenic, but like split personality type thing. But he didn't get any treatment or anything for that. He just kind of went along like, I don't know, maybe they decided he was just going to kind of outgrow it or something like that, but he never got any other treatment for it. So he went on to kind of flounder a bit after high school. He dropped out of college during his first year, got a few jobs through his father. One of them was at a local paper as like a copy boy. He was described as being eager and kind of obsessed with being like a someone, or at least seen as a somebody, but he never really fit in with his coworkers. He just kind of like he had never fit in at school. He just didn't fit in very well. Like there was the time that he decided to offer to drive a few students to a football game at Indiana University, and then he showed up to drive them in a hearse. Well, he eventually moved on to a job with the DMV, which he continued to be weird at. In 1971, he met his wife, Julie, at the Methodist Church through some friends. They were both Republicans and both had a desire to one day start their own businesses. So they had a few things in common. And they married in November of that year. Julie had been a high school journalism teacher, but after they had gotten married, she quit to be a stay-at-home mom, and they wound up having three kids, Marie, Eric, and Emily, who was the youngest. And then one day at the DMV, he decided to urinate on a letter addressed to the governor of Indiana, like while he was at work. And so he got himself fired, naturally. So Julie went back to teaching, and Herb got a job at like a thrift store because it was kind of the only job that he could really find that would take him with all his weirdness and all that. But it all kind of worked out in the end, because while he was there, he got this idea that there was quite a bit of money to be made in thrifting. So he borrowed some money from his parents and opened up his own thrift shop, which was called the Save-A-Lot. And it had a really good, solid business plan. It was the Children's Bureau charity that owned most of the inventory, but they would, through a contract, receive a portion of the proceeds from the sales. And it did well enough for them that when they opened a second store within like a year, and it allowed the family to have the funds to buy this Fox Hollow Farms and its beautiful two-door style mansion. And so Mary went to her boss asking for a search warrant for the property, but they didn't really have enough to suspect that Herb was this serial murderer of men. So they had to start by asking nicely if they could search the property. And of course he says, like, go fluff yourself. But Julie's name was on the property as well. So maybe they would have like a little better luck asking her, to which she also told them to go fluff themselves. Like, Herb had told her that they were going to accuse him of falsely of theft and that he was going to be getting a lawyer. But when Mary said to her, like, you know, this isn't actually about any kind of theft, and she actually laid out their suspicions to her, like, she looked at them like she had just spoken out of her armpits. And she's like, there's no way. Like, now you're really not going to be searching my property. Like, you guys are off your rockers. So they were kind of SOL for now. But remember, what solves cold cases in a lot of cases is changes in relationships. Well, this change was a little subtle at first. Julie called Mary one day and yelled at her through the phone, like, the police are not coming to my house, tearing through things, upsetting my children, all on the word of a psycho named Tony Harris, whom my husband has never even heard of, end quote. Seems like there's a little bit of chaos going on in the Baumeister household. So they waited out a little bit more, about 6 months, in fact, just enough time for Herb to kind of fall apart at the seams. So much so that the children's charity actually canceled their contract with Save-A-Lot, and they decided to separate as a couple. In fact, Herb was acting so erratic that she was beginning to wonder about his mental state and these rumors that the police had told her about. And so she kind of cast her memory back to about 2 years before, when her son Eric, who was 13 at the time, had been out playing in the yard and found this half-buried human skull. And actually, he had found a complete skeleton, but he just brought the skull to his mom to let her see it. And so when Herb had come home from work, he had explained rather calmly that, oh, that was just one of his dad's medical skeletons. He had it stored in the garage, and then he decided to bury it when he cleaned out the garage. And that story had made sense, I guess, until it didn't. So on June 23rd, 1996, she went to her lawyer, Bill, and told her to let Mary know that Herb was away and that her son was visiting his grandma at Lake Wawasee and that they could search the property. In fact, Julie revealed to her that the kids often went out to her parents' cabin, sometimes for weeks at a time, which left Herb at home because of the pressures of work. He always stayed behind. And that he had told her that he was insecure about his thinness. He was a rather thin man. So that was why he always changed in the bathroom. And she had, in the 25 years that they'd been married, never actually seen him nude. And in fact, they had only consummated the marriage 6 times over those 25 years. And remember, they had 3 kids. So I guess that's 2 tries for each one. The sex thing is weird, but anyone that has cohabitated, like, in any kind of romantic relationship for a time knows that there's actually a lot of nudity involved, and most of it isn't romantic. It's like the, you know, can you grab a flashlight and look at this, and like, is that a pimple on my butt right there kind of thing. So that would have been a bit of a tip off to me that there was something a little bit up with Herb. Now, the house itself had grown a bit neglected. There was some clutter. These majestic lawns that it originally had were a little bit overgrown. And the day after hearing from Julie's lawyer, Mary's takes along her captain, Tom Anderson, and there was a major crimes detective, Jeff Markham. And Mary's actually, she's a little worried that this is going to turn out to be a case of like animal bones and, or maybe a grudge from an ex-lover that has led them there. But she has, like, she has to take a shot. And this, so this is either going to make her career or possibly break it. And Anderson had even muttered under his breath things like bullshit under his breath about what a waste of time this was going to be, tearing up the lawn of this pillar of the community, church member and possible political contributor to the community police funds. So Julie, with her lawyer in tow, met the three of them at the door and led them through the house, which was cluttered and neglected. And then she took them outside to the woods that were sort of around the backyard and pointed to where Eric had found this skull and the skeleton. And they kind of kicked the grass a little bit and a little bit of dirt, loosened up what looked like a foot bone, which was probably animal. They figured that, although it was a little bit odd that it appeared charred, they looked around and they noticed that there were actually all these little like rocks and pebbles around. And when they took a closer look at them, they realized that they were also small little bits of bone. And Julie's lawyer, Bill, was kind of watching them gathering these rocks up and examining them. And he looks down at his feet and notices that there's like this human tooth. So Mary took what they had bagged up as evidence, like so far, to forensic anthropologist Stephen Narocki, who was from the university. And he took a quick look at them, like a really quick look at them, and said, they're human, they're recent, and they've been burned. So the next day they returned, this time with backup officers, and they were prepared for like a proper dig of the whole property. And there was anthropologist Stephen and a couple of his students, they came as well to kind of give like some scientific exhumation professionalism to everything. And they started by placing little orange flags down by each fragment as they found it. And within a half an hour, they had planted about 100 of these little flags. And the excavation went on well into the night with, like, they had trouble lamps set up and about 60 volunteers of off-duty police officers, firefighters. And over the next couple of days, they discovered 5,500 bones and different fragments of human beings. And as they were starting to get to like the edge of the property, there were neighbors from the farm adjacent to them that approached a couple of the officers to let them know that they had found some bones as well. And there was this drainage ditch that separates the properties. And this ditch was like filled with backbones and ribs. They were just sticking up from the mud. They also uncovered some cans of Miller Genuine Draft beer, which was Herb's favorite, and some handcuffs that had probably slid off the victim's wrists as they started to skeletonize. The count at the end, they think, was around 11 men.
The biggest news from Fox Hollow Farm on this Wednesday came early.
Positively, five bodies out there. By the bones he found yesterday, I believe they found about 75 bones. And through that, they was able to identify the two other bodies definitely were out there, so we do have five.
Authorities still believe the bones have been buried in the 18-acre estate for the last 9 to 18 months. Anthropologists say the bones are definitely that of adults. Now, that was likely help law enforcement, but it's not enough.
We have nothing at this time, and will not until the anthropologist can give us some kind of sex and hopefully a cause of death.
Digging at the site concluded today. A search party walked through the property is scheduled for Friday.
It's real frustrating. I mean, you know, we have to wait. Everybody's curious. We have our own thoughts, but we have to wait until we get an answer from the anthropologist.
That's expected to take 30 to 40 days.
Police also searching inside the home found the mannequins, the wet bar in the pool, just like Tony had described it to them. They also found a hidden video camera. Now, the tapes that they suspect exist actually of the murders, like snuff films, if you will, they've actually never been found. And the more they started to find, the more Julie starts to freak out that, I mean, currently he's in his dad's custody out at Lake Wawasee. And if he got wind of what was happening back at the house, like things could get really ugly. But he actually appeared none the wiser when the sheriff's department showed up with like a custody order that they had drawn up to take Eric home. And like Herb didn't really bat an eye at that. He just figured it was, you know, kind of part of the normal custody thing that they were going through because they were separated at the time. Meanwhile, back at Fox Hollow, investigators found a number of compost piles that contained some bone pieces. So Herb had disposed of the bodies by burning them under like piles of leaves and grass. And Julie explained that, particularly in the summertime, she would sometimes take the kids and be at the cabin for sometimes the whole summer at a time, leaving Herb to his own devices. And a lot of these disappearances, of course, happened in July and August. And so the time had come, it was time to arrest Herb Baumeister. But they couldn't find him at Lake Wawasee in that cabin where he said he had been. His brother Brad actually called detectives on June 29th that Herb had phoned him from Michigan saying that he was on this business trip and he needed some money for some reason or another and that he needed it quickly. And so Brad had sent him the money, but then learned like what they had started discovering on his property. And he decided maybe it was best to let the police know. And so it appeared that he was on the run. And they believe that he's facing bankruptcy. He was facing his divorce. Then, of course, the pressure of everything just kind of falling in around him. He had gotten into his Buick and then drove to Michigan on the 28th.
The crime tape came down today. After finding skeletal remains, five people here, investigators say the search is over. It was early last fall when Herbert Baumeister's kids found a human skull on the property. Baumeister is said to have taken it away and explained that it was somehow related to his father's work as a physician. The skull has not been seen since. About the same time, an informant told Indianapolis police that Herb Baumeister was the last one seen with a missing person they were looking for. But Baumeister refused to talk to the cops. By then, his personal and professional life was crumbling. His wife filed for divorce. He was falling deeper and deeper in debt, trying to maintain this Hamilton County estate, along with this place, a home he'd moved out of some 3 years ago in Castleton. It seems Baumeister had less than a cordial relationship with some of his neighbors here. They say he flatly refused to sell his house or even repair his house, all the time insisting that he lived here, even though the home is obviously vacant. Neighbors are curious about why Baumeister kept the house and what he has inside. And while warring with some of his neighbors, Baumeister's business was falling apart. Employees say Baumeister owes thousands of dollars in back pay and for bounce checks and other debts.
They didn't get their money, and the electricity didn't get paid, and all that stuff, so they shut the power off.
He and his wife operated two Save-A-Lot thrift stores in Indianapolis. They had a contract with the Children's Bureau and had agreed that a percentage of the proceeds, about $4,000 a month, would go to the Bureau. But then the money stopped, and all the Children's Bureau got was complaints about Baumeister. Some workers say his behavior was unusual.
All he would hire was teenage students or...
Boys, mainly?
Boys, that's it. A couple times he said, well, I got to take them home. He'll leave, and he doesn't come back till noon the next day.
The Children's Bureau ended the contract with Baumeister 2 weeks ago. About the same time, human bones surfaced again at his estate.
He arrived in Sarnia, Ontario, Canada, on the 30th. He spent a couple of days kind of wandering around before he headed east, winding along Lake Huron shoreline until he reached Grand Bend, Ontario. He parked his car at Pinery Park, and then on the 3rd of July, he wrote a note that his business was failing, his marriage had crumbled, and like he didn't mention anything about any bones, skeletons, gay men or strangulation, kinky sex, nothing like that. And he ended the note that he was going to eat a peanut butter sandwich and then go to sleep. So he then pulled out his 357 revolver and shot, 357 revolver and shot himself in the head. What is interesting is that the night before this, he was actually stopped by a Canadian RCMP officer for sleeping in his car near a bridge. He said that he was a tourist that was just passing through. And the officer did notice luggage in the car, but also there was a pile of videotapes cluttering up like the back seat. The tapes were not found in the car where he parked it at the park. They have actually never been found. And Virgil says, were these videotapes of the murders that he committed in the pool at Fox Hollow Farms? Like, we're never going to know that. After he died, there was no signs of the tapes on him, near him, in the car. So they figure he must have maybe tossed them into the lake before he shot himself. And according to him, perhaps it's for the best. And so it took until September before the anthropologist had some names for the investigators from dental records. There was Roger Allen Goodlett, Stephen Hale, Richard Hamilton, Manuel Resendez, but there was a lot more that needed to be identified. And Virgil had always felt that there were some strong connections between the men in Indianapolis and the earlier I-70 murders. So he took his suspicions to the prosecutor David Linloft, and he agreed that he did look good for them. Like Herb had made a number of business trips to Ohio during the 1990s. Julie was approached. She was pretty sure by this time, pretty accepting that the fact was that the man that she had been married to for 25 years of her life, she had three children with, was a murderer of the serial variety. So she provided them with like all the credit card receipts that she had, phone records, full access to his Buick that she had, anything that she could dig up. Now Herb's picture was identified by a witness that provided the police sketch initially that they had. And another one came forward saying that his face was the same one that had drove his friend Michael Riley home one night from the bar in 1988. So the police issued a press release that they believe that Herb Baumeister was the I-70 killer, that everything pointed to him being the person, including the fact that the roadside dumping stopped at the same time that he bought the Fox Hollow Farms, complete with his more private grave sites that he had. Virgil also finds it interesting that Herb's other brother, Richard, lived in Texas. What's strange is that Richard Baumeister was found dead in the early 90s in his pool, which sounds a bit familiar. Now, of all the remains that have been found at Fox Hollow, it is estimated that there's about maybe 25 men buried there. Alan Livingston was identified in 2023, and then in 2024, Jeffrey Jones was identified from some familiar DNA samples. There is currently a team that's working on identifying all of the dead men that are buried there, and they would like to hear from any relatives of missing men from in and around the Indianapolis and Ohio areas from 1978 to 1996. So relatives of missing men who want to provide family DNA reference samples for this effort to identify these men can contact the Indiana State Police Missing Persons Unit. They have a number at 833-466-2653, or they can contact the Hamilton County Coroner's Office at 317-770-4415. Fox Hollow Farms was sold to a man named Robert Graves in 2007, and his family's actually been living there ever since then. He's not sure if it's haunted or not, but he often welcomes a lot of paranormal investigators in to do their kind of thing. He's also been more than happy to help with the search for more bones. He said, quote, there's certainly a lot of families that don't have answers. And maybe with a new technology, they can get some answers because there's a lot of guys that are still not identified, end quote. Now, you can find out a lot of videos and YouTube podcasts, all that stuff on the Fox Hollow Farms. But most of them are about like the possible hauntings. Very few of them are actually about the men that, you know, once made their families smile and laugh. It has since been revealed that Tony Harris is actually Mark Goodyear. And there's some interesting things about him. So a while back, there was this documentary done on the case. And Goodyear was in that documentary. And he had told police, of course, at the time, all kinds of things about Bowmeister that suggested that he was maybe a little bit more involved, or that it was a little bit more of an involved relationship than just this one creepy encounter. And initially the fact that he kind of knew all this stuff about the mannequins, the pool, etc., it seemed a little bit convenient to them even at the time. Now, since then, Mark has actually come out and admitted that he lied about all of that. Instead, he now says that him and Herb were actually friends, like good friends for quite a while, and that he had once made him watch these videotapes that have never surfaced, and that Herb once told him that he had killed 56 people and showed him these fire pits or compost piles where he had burned them. Now, he also told this documentary that he was with Herb when the police arrived at the farm to search, that they were kind of watching it all go down on the news from his house. But like he says he was never involved in any of the murders himself. Quote, he was just trying to take me down with him, but guess what? He's fucking dead, ain't he? End quote. Now, he has never been implicated, and there is no evidence that he helped in any way with any of the murders. I think he's never been charged or prosecuted or anything like that. I think he's got a little bit of a credibility issue. However, there has been some speculation that Herb had some help from somebody moving bodies and whatnot, but I don't know. I don't think that you have to necessarily take a fitness test in order to be a serial killer to move bodies around. So I don't know. From what I have read of Mark Goodyear, I think he's kind of a little bit brash. He's a little boastful, and like, who knows what's true and what's just him wanting a little bit of attention. Like I said, I think he's got a little bit of a credibility issue, but he is, like, it was him that led to the Fox Hollow Farm. So good job. So that was the Fox Hollow Farms murder, also the I-70 murders. I'm going to be back again next week with another case. And in the meantime, you just do your regular blah, blah, blah stuff, like, subscribe, review. Do not forget that there is exclusive episodes both on Red Circle that you can sign up for and also on Patreon. And as always, thank you so much for listening.